Welcome to Bee's Table Talk, the new St. Paul Area Chamber of Commerce podcast. I'm your host, Bee Kyle, President and CEO. We are hosted by Ian Levitt in their amazing Studio Americana here in Minneapolis. We're excited to bring this programming to you. Throughout the year, we meet fascinating, accomplished people, always willing to talk with us, but not necessarily available to fit into our event schedule. So this podcast is our attempt to capture these conversations and share them with our membership and the broader employer community, and through a medium that fits our increasingly mobile lifestyles. Today's show features my good friend Mark Stutrud, principal, president, founder, CEO, chief bottle washer of Summit Brewing.
You forgot Chief Knucklehead.
Thank you for reminding me of that. And so welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you.
Delighted to have you.
It's a pleasure being with you.
Wonderful. So really, we'd like to introduce to the world to the Mark Stutrud that I've gotten introduced to over the years. So if you'd be so kind as to start by giving us a sense of how in the world you got involved in beer in St. Paul, Minnesota. Let's start from the beginning.
Well, it started with a degree in social work. And following that degree in social work, I was trained in family therapy. Found myself working in the chemical dependency industry, working with adolescents and young adults in hospital-based treatment programs. And that's how I ended up moving to the Twin Cities in 1980 to have a supervisory position at a major hospital-based program in Minneapolis at the time. So when you or anybody else asked me, how the heck did you end up in the brewing business? You know, I can't make this stuff up.
Right.
But literally what happened to me during my previous career's journey was I found myself stuck in middle management, where I had a lot of responsibility but no authority. Mm. And at that time, St. Mary's Hospital, where this program was, which was now in Fairview Riverside, hospital. It was also a Catholic hierarchy. So, you know, for a Norwegian Lutheran with a lot of control issues, I had some problems. So I thought I'd better start thinking about what else I was going to do with my life. Mm. And at the time, back in 1982, I considered medical school with the idea of looking at psychiatry, and I'd look at a couple of psychiatrists I'd fight with on a daily basis. Private practice, going into private practice, doing therapy was an option. But the fact that I was a beer drinker and a home brewer, I went on this fantasy of just doing some exploring, of starting a small brewery in the Twin Cities area. So literally, for 2 years, I did a feasibility study of I did serious research in the industry, meeting people. All of my vacation time at St. Mary's Hospital was spent apprenticing at breweries to the chagrin of a lot of the staff. I would go away for vacation. I'd come back. They were interested what brewery I worked at this time. So it really led to developing serious relationships and actually believing that the metropolitan area could handle a really tiny brewery back in 1986. So in the beginning of 1984, I started working on getting the company going full-time, completed the market research, the business plan, started attending brewing school. I had two master brewers as personal mentors and trainers. And through contacts of the Department of Economic Development at the City of St. Paul, I got involved through them, mentorship in accounting and crash courses on basic business elements, as well as signing up for SCORE for business counseling through that SBA-based program. And was very fortunate to have been assigned a retired executive who used to own a beverage company in St. Paul and sold it to Beatrice Foods several years previous. So I really am a product of many mentors and serious and thorough research.
That's fabulous.
And retooling.
What does retooling mean?
Well, you know, it's giving up a past profession and going to brewing school and really studying and learning the trade. Because brewing is a very, very technical profession. It's a skill. You really need to know what you're doing, but particularly when you get on a commercial scale. I mean, being a home brewer is absolutely no set of credentials to get into a commercial enterprise. You really need to have the expertise, the training. Particularly, it's one thing to make a glass of beer, have all your buddies and families enjoy it. It's another thing to make exactly that same glass of beer time and time again. Mm-hmm. And then even after you achieve that consistency and reliability, packaging is a whole nother area where you can really screw everything up. Mm-hmm. And quality control is essential. It's food manufacturing.
Right, right.
So somehow, you know, opening up a brewery is a lot sexier than starting a dairy, you know. So, and a lot of people have gotten into the industry now, and some are trained and quite a few are not.
Mm. How old were you when you started the business in 1986?
Well, I was we sold our first keg of beer in 1986. I was 34. When I started doing research, I was 30.
How did you feel about this? Were you scared to get into this venture on your own?
Well, the nature, I think, of the entrepreneurial experience is that you get used to a certain level of fear. Mm. It's very important not to be paralyzed by being so scared of losing your house or everything that you have that the banker might take that's been pledged. And you know, personal guarantees are, that's a point of seriousness. But, you know, Jerry Mogul, this fellow who owned this beverage company, growing up, again, I should back up a little bit. Both of my folks were educators. My father was a vocational educator, and he taught graphic arts. He also owned a small newspaper for 10 years. My mother was an elementary school teacher. So I was not brought up in a business environment, you know, through my family. And when I would look at people that were in business, I thought, well, you know, their timing was good or they were lucky. And Jerry Mogul, my business mentor, very quickly illustrated to me that luck is created out of hard work. Mm. So there's a certain amount of commitment, tenacity. I think with my DNA, again, it can be translated into stubbornness. Mm-hmm. But you get to the point of, yeah, you have some fearful moments, but you have to act as if you're not that afraid and keep going. You may not have that baseline of confidence yet, but you really need to stick to the action, make decisions, keep working. Get up the next morning and do it again.
Hmm. Nice.
It's a pretty simple formula.
Hmm. Well, tell us about a letter. I know about this letter that you received when you were first starting out.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us the story about that letter?
Oh, the one from William O'Shea from the Brewers Association of the Americas, where I, in 1983, a part of my research, I was getting in touch with trade associations and organizations within the industry, and I sent a letter off to Bill. And at the Brewers Association, those were all of the survivors, the small regional brewers. Shells is an example of a survivor today down in New Ulm. But there were a handful of breweries yet in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. And these were the folks that were really able to survive this consolidation that happened with the industry after, you know, into the 50s and 60s. And Bill O'Shea saw more breweries close under his tenure than open. So he wasn't really accustomed to receiving a letter from some knucklehead asking about membership in the organization. and wanting to know more about the industry. So he was very discouraging. And he literally said, I really don't think you should do this because you have no idea how long and hard this road is that you'll be going down to actually get going. So he was being very honest. He wasn't, and he wasn't the only person that told me that it was kind of a crazy idea. I mean, for after all, that letter was kinder than what my father said when I first brought up the idea. Because I had shared a number of pretty flaky ideas with my father previously. And he said, yeah, this is probably the wildest one you've come up with yet, Mark. And by the way, don't ask me for any money. So that was pretty much on my own. But yeah, no, Bill O'Shea was really a, he was a straightforward man.
Well, tell me a little bit about the transformation then of your business. Before you do that, though, actually, you took me on a tour, the Brewers tour, back in 2006, your building, and I got to see the tanks, and you told me a story about where you got those tanks. I thought that was fascinating, and I've remembered it. Can you share that with us?
Oh, absolutely. The facility that we're currently in, we broke ground in January of 1997. It was about 18 months of construction. We moved in December of 1998. This the facility that we're in is really a testament to our customers. They're responsible for the that reality of the beautiful facility, the beautiful brewery we're in today. Certainly was not in my original business plan. It was quite a few years of planning, and in fact, it was going back to 1994. I was screening and looking over classified ads in German brewing journals to find a used copper brew house. And the brew house is the hot side. That's where you mix water and crushed malt and you make a mash and then you separate the liquid from the mash and they, you boil that liquid and add hops. And then after you cool that liquid down, then it goes through fermentation. So this is kind of the heart and soul of an operation. This is where every batch starts. And we had had another used German brew house in our original brewery on University Avenue, which was actually built in 1938. It was a functioning antique that somehow survived. It wasn't turned into armaments and stuff like that. So we were determined to find another larger German brew house to put into the new facility. So we literally bought that and shipped it over to the U.S. 2 years before we even broke ground on the new brewery in 97. It came from the village of Ansbach. The brewery, the family was Herner, and Hernerbräu was the brewery. When I spent 6 weeks over there supervising the removal and packing and shipping of the equipment, the brewmaster there didn't talk to me for the first month.
Oh, no.
Well, I was this Yankee that was tearing a bit of the soul out of the village.
Right.
But we made up for it. The last 2 weeks I was there, we shared several beers together. And there have been people from Ansbach that have been to the brewery several times, so it's a lot of fun. Now, when we bought this equipment, all of these copper vessels, and these vessels were fabricated in 1971. It was a new addition that was built on to an existing brewery that had been around for close to 200 years. There wasn't anybody in the family that wanted to keep the brewery going, so they sold the interest to another brewery in Nuremberg, which is only about 40 kilometers away. And the two breweries eventually consolidated. The big brewery in Nuremberg shut down the one in Ansbach, and then they moved the production to Nuremberg. That's how this equipment came up for sale. Well, we not only bought the equipment, but we also, with the purchase, we got all of the structural plans of this new addition that was built in 1971. So when you pull into our parking lot and look at the brewery, literally we transposed that piece of that brewery that was in Germany. So it really is a nice, very real experience of tradition and heritage and legacy of this industry. So it's a very classically designed structure. And Peter O'Brien, who is the architect, a fellow from St. Paul, over several beers, when we're thinking about the design and the construction of the new brewery, we were thinking about what a brewery might look like had one been built during Prohibition. So that's why it has what I guess I would describe a minimalistic, a deco feel to it. And obviously we could not afford the Victorian extravagant architecture that happened in the previous century. So then all of this copper equipment, it was about 12 truckloads.
12 semi-trailer truckloads.
Yes, yeah. And they were sitting in one of the trailers, for example, would just haul a big box that had the brew kettle in it, which was about 18 feet high by 16 feet in diameter. As we shipped the vessels intact, we had to construct crates to protect them. The closest port we could get the shipment in was Milwaukee. Duluth typically does not deal in boxes and containers. It's all bulk. Mm. Well, in June of 95, I get a call from the port of Milwaukee, and they let me know that they had an accident, and a crane operator had dropped one of our 40-foot shipping containers. And in that container was quite a bit of equipment, a lot of malt handling equipment, but also the original control panel.
No.
Yeah, it wasn't a happy moment. But wow. Accidentally, then, I ended up working with a small family business outside of Munich in the town of Freising. It was a family business where they specialized in process control and automation systems for small to medium-sized breweries around the world. We were the second brewery that this company worked with in the U.S. Since then, and with the explosion of new breweries in the U.S., have done multiple installations. So again, we were not only pioneers going back in 1986, but we were also pioneers of taking this very traditional copper brew house and coupling that with present-day technology of process control and automation.
Which you've continued to upgrade.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And since then, you know, we built a new fermentation cellar. We finished that in September of 2013, where we doubled our production. And the new cellar is 100% automated. It has a level of technology that you just don't see at our scale. And in fact, it's a type of technology that some breweries that Anheuser-Busch InBev wish they did have that incorporated in their places.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever imagine, thinking back to 1986, University Avenue, take us there, what was the size of your building, and what in your wildest dreams did you imagine happening 33 years later?
Well, sure. We started in 7,500 square feet of space. I had five employees. We had a capacity of 3,000 barrels a year. We did secure the lease to a second building, which was across the back alley, where we tripled our size. So we had about 22,000 square feet total. And over a period of 12 years, I ended up having 10 full-time and 15 part-time employees. And we produced 34,000 barrels out of that space before we moved to the new facility in Crosby Park, Crosby Lake Business Park. Now, in my wildest dreams, I thought that the Twin Cities could support a brewery that would do 25,000 barrels of beer a year. And I'd have about 25 employees and be able to have most weekends off. That was pretty much the expectations, you know, beyond just thoughts of survival the first three, four years. Going back, I mean, it's amazing that we survived. because we were so far ahead of the curve. We self-distributed our first year out of necessity. Beer wholesalers wouldn't even talk to us. We were looked at as being such deviants that they couldn't believe that anybody would be buying the beer that we were producing. So it wasn't until into our second year that we could actually even have a conversation with a beer distributor to pick up our products.
That's even before I could get to the bar or the restaurant.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. The distributor is that person in between the brewer and the retail accounts, whether or not it's a liquor store or a bar. And it gets expensive to do both when you hit a certain scale. When you're small and if your distribution territory or area is really tight, it's quite possible, but it wouldn't make any sense for us to drive kegs of beer up to Duluth, for example. So that's where a beer distributor is really instrumental in terms of growth and making sure that your beer is accessible to the end consumer, to the beer drinker.
So when you're delivering product via keg or originally bottles only, do you have a geography beyond which you really can't go in terms of freshness of the beer or anything like that?
Well, when you're dealing with non-pasteurized beer, to keep things fresh, you keep it refrigerated at the brewery, at your distributor's warehouse, and during transport, particularly if it's over a few hours. Now, if you produce beer carefully, and if you filter it so that you've got some flavor stability and some shelf stability. For our beer, it can be on a floor display in a liquor store for a week or two without any problem. So it doesn't need to be refrigerated the entire time, but refrigeration, it'll abate and inhibit the oxidation process, which is the aging process of beer, which happens to all beer. And it's that oxidation process, the flavor effects of just oxidation are more noticeable the more light the beer is in flavor, color, and character.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're making a high alcoholic, highly hopped IPA, immediately you've got a little bit of resistance of dealing with some of the flavors that emerge from oxidation. They don't become as apparent as if you're making a Pilsner. So it's people really don't understand how perishable beer really is. You really have to be careful, for example, if we were shipping beer from, say, St. Paul to New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're really looking at the length of time. This is one of the reasons why we don't export any beer. We could sell beer in Australia and load up a sea container and have it be on the ocean. And if it's not refrigerated, well, then it prematurely ages before it gets to the customer. And that's where pasteurization kind of comes in, where if you pasteurize your beer, you prematurely age it a little bit, but then you lock in those flavors for an extended period of time. So it's a technique that's important if you're in a national distribution point, and this is one of the reasons why Sierra Nevada, other breweries have breweries on the West Coast and the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
Due to that, not only the perishability of the beer, but also just the price of transportation and freight.
Because you don't have to refrigerate it.
No, you should anyway. Okay. If it's a flavorful beer, you should take care of it.
Okay.
Yep.
So tell us what the story is behind the name Summit.
Oh, well, going back to end of 83, beginning of 84, there is a group of attorneys. Some folks from advertising agencies, some neighbors. we had, I think it would be an overstatement to call it a focus group, but we had group discussions over quite a few beers on what we could christen this new brewery that was going to be based in St. Paul. We had a lot of regional names. I mean, Pig's Eye, for example, was a name that did pop up mm-hmm. within the group of people. You think of Father Hennepin, you think of a number of things. There were regional names, place names, Native American references that were historic. So there was about 200 different names that were generated, but it came down to Summit, primarily because it identifies us with St. Paul due to Summit Avenue, where, as you know, the town was established down on the river bottoms. And then as the railroad men and the bankers and the brewers and some of the lumbermen got more successful, they moved, started building mansions up on top of the bluff to establish Summit Avenue. And I like to confuse people from Colorado. That's okay, you know. Bottom line, though, it's a hell of a lot easier to pronounce and say than Stutrud.
Right.
And we knew that there was going to be quite a bit of reluctance, maybe some anxiety of ordering this new beer. We didn't want to create any more anxiety for mm-hmm. the person who might want to order this new beer. Mm-hmm. So Summit is easy to say.
Mm-hmm. It's easy to drink, too. I just got to say that out loud.
There you go. And remarkably, when I did a trademark search, and today when you think about all the different names mm-hmm. that are out there with different breweries,
it
was remarkable when I did a trademark search that there was never a Summit Brewing Company that had ever been registered in the country. Mm-hmm. Wild River, yes, which was another one of the ones we thought of, but Summit, it really stuck. And then also we can use the imagery of the apex mm-hmm. of excellence of brewing,
mm-hmm.
A number of things. So it was just a very, very strong brand for us.
So you're thinking 33 years ago, you actually started business, and it hasn't been an easy ride. We'll talk about the current scene
sure.
a little while later, but I'd like for you to go back with us and share with us one or two of the real obstacles that could have derailed you, mm-hmm. defeated you,
mm-hmm.
Simply required that you move back to North Dakota and call it quits. Dad, you were right. I'm coming home.
I'm going to start a commune on the homestead.
Absolutely.
That was one of the other ideas. Yeah.
Oh, great, great. And he thought beer was crazier than that. Boy, that is something.
Well, growing pot wasn't a part of it, as I remember.
Okay, I'm with you. All right. So a couple of obstacles. You had, this has been a rocky road for you.
It's not easy being the first.
Mm-hmm.
There's an old adage that it's the pioneers that die first, and they die young.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question that we were breaking new ground, and what we were doing, we cultivated the marketplace and made it easier for others to follow. There's no question that was a part of the experience. The first challenge really was establishing credibility with the retail customer.
Mm-hmm.
Thankfully, there were enough independent restaurant and bar and tavern owners and operators and chefs that were aware of what was going on within the wine industry. When I grew up, it was rosé and Chablis and red wine, and then people would say, well, you want that red wine cold, not very sophisticated. Well, that's pretty much what beer drinking was like in the early 80s and even before that. But what was going on in, towards the late 70s, early 80s, that's when the varietals started emerging in California, and people were really focused on styles of wine in so many different ways than before. And wine had, had elevated, I guess, in terms of appreciation, particularly wines that were domestically produced. They were competitive and, you know, as far as integrity and character with wines from France and Germany, wherever. That was a glimmer of hope and a baseline of communication with some of the early customers. The people who embraced us typically were chefs, people who traveled, those who had had, you know, beer experiences in England, Ireland, or Germany, or Czech. You were able to communicate with those folks pretty well. And then they really wanted to check you out after that. Mm-hmm. So consistency, reliability, having a flavor profile that was unique but also pretty satisfying. Another mentor of mine, Fred Thomas, a retired brewmaster from St. Paul, really stressed about designing and brewing beers that really would touch the subconscious in a way to where you might not be able to articulate what it is that you enjoy. You just know you'd like to have another one.
Mm-hmm.
And he always said it has to taste like more. So that's what we would describe as that subjective experience of balance or drinkability. And yet to be unique. And also we saw ourselves as being really responsible of re-educating the beer drinker again and getting closer to reincorporating and fostering a true beer culture in our society, because we had lost so much of our culture when it relates to beer during Prohibition.
Mm.
So literally there's a lot of historical touch points in tradition that we could bring forward into the 80s and talk about the classic styles that have been lost for so many years. Now, it's a lot of words. You still have to sell a keg of beer on the street, right?
Right.
So I think after 6 months, we probably had 50 customers. You know, we did not turn a profit until we were around for 4 years.
That's hard.
We hung in there.
You hung in there.
Oh, sure. You know, we got some more investors. We also didn't have a strong balance sheet. So, you know, the banker put us on probation for a while because we were just not cutting it. But at the time that we started to hit some credibility with the retailers, that was at the same time, after that first year, that we switched over from self-distribution to working with distributors. We had to achieve and gain their confidence. And I remember very clearly the first few months after we started working with beer wholesalers, I would get a call from a liquor store and they would say, "How do I get your beer?" I said, "Well, XYZ distributor handles our products." And the liquor store owner would say, "Well, that's pretty funny, because a sales guy was just here and didn't mention once that they carried your product." Well, there wasn't any comfort level.
Mm.
There wasn't any degree of confidence to even present us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was critical that we had our own people on the street to be very active in sales.
And they got in to train the distributors, introduce them to the product, encourage them to sell it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we rely on our distributors not only to deliver our beer, but also to represent us.
Right, right.
And today, that is really continues to be a huge challenge. So that is a challenge that has not changed over the past 32 years, primarily because there has been a very significant consolidation at the distribution tier. There's about, I would say, close to 50% fewer beer distributors in the state of Minnesota today than when we started the brewery. So there are fewer distributors, their territories are larger, and then the portfolios of all the different products that they present and deliver is much deeper. So literally, the competition for mind share, for market share, for sales starts in the distributor's warehouse. And that is just as strong today as it was back in the mid-80s.
A lot of control over what gets sold where.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And sometimes there isn't a choice. You know, if we went to a rural area, there may be just one distributor or maybe two mm-hmm. left in a certain area.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes it even more difficult to be able to get your beer in front of people. Mm-hmm. So having critical mass, sales volume, it's important. I mean, we certainly have a high margin beer that's very attractive to a distributor, but you also have to hit a certain critical volume in order to maintain that relationship sometimes.
I can imagine that's a challenge as well. Once you get picked up by a distributor, now you're obligated to deliver at a volume that's acceptable for them.
Well, that's where you have to, it's very important to have done your research and have a brewery that's prepared to do the output. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So speaking of the market, you quietly enter the market in 1986, and in the last year, this last year alone, over 23 new beer products entered the market. Beer brands.
New breweries, yeah.
Breweries. Mm-hmm. And that's not a standalone year. There's been an explosion of these mm-hmm. craft brews mm-hmm. in the last... Well, tell us a little bit about what that has looked like. How long has this explosion been going on? How has that impacted your business? And then, frankly, how have you sustained your leadership in an ever-diversifying market?
Well, it's been the past almost 9 years that there's really been an influx of new brewers into the marketplace. That is directly related to the taproom law, where brewers can have a retail operation on premise, where they're able to sell their glasses of beer on a retail basis or send growlers to go or what have you. That was definitely a point of change within the industry. The getting into brewing is extremely capital intensive, and particularly when you not only construct a facility that's technically sound, but also has a significant laboratory where you're doing the appropriate quality control and quality assurance. Sadly, with quite a few folks, that's been an afterthought. But each time that you grow, and as you scale up, it becomes more capital intense. It's not just buying more kegs. It's also looking at capacity. It's also having more of a sophistication within the technology and application to really incorporate the efficiencies that you need when you get larger. It's just damned expensive. So you can be successful and be very small today. In some cases, a lot of these smaller breweries are, you know, it's like being in the bar business. They're producing beer in-house, and they sell it in-house primarily. They might have a handful of outside customers, other bars, what have you, but the majority of their revenue is based at home. Now, that business model, essentially, you're looking at some type of a cap of your volume or your revenue eventually. You know, if you started out in 1,000 square feet of space, which is quite a bit of space for a tap room, and then you think, well, geez, I'm going to go to 3,000 square feet of space and have more chairs, well, then you have to create multiple other reasons to retain those people and to attract new business. So it's not just always about just the beer. Mm-hmm. And then that's what some of these folks are working through. When we started up, having a retail business was not legal. So literally, we were really relying on the distributors and our retail customers to really be a part of our growth curve. This is one of the reasons why we have utmost respect for all of our retail customers, because they've brought us to this point. They've been a part of this journey, and I'm not personally interested in being in the bar business where we have our tap room open for 4 days out of the week. It's a time for the public can come in and they don't feel compelled to be on a tour to get a glass of beer. They can buy a pint and hang out, and then we encourage them to go out and support our customers. I'm not interested in doing wedding receptions. I like it when Pat Mancini does those, and and when that that wedding party orders a few extra kegs of Summit. That's our business model. That's why we primarily pay the bills. But for every brewery that's out there, there's a different business model in so many ways. And right now, you see most of the folks opening up very small establishments. It's affordable. If you think $1 million to $3 million is affordable. But beyond that, if you're going to construct a brewery that can do 20,000 barrels, it quickly becomes very serious. In order to have a return on that investment or to pay the banker, you have to hit that volume pretty quickly these days, which is challenging. There's no question that there's saturation today. Mm-hmm. When you walk into a liquor store and you're confronted with cooler doors of a variety of styles and breweries that are presenting their beer, and how frequently that changes, it's a very competitive environment. We have quite a few years, a few decades of experience of becoming known as being reliable and trustworthy and consistent, and that we always never compromise on our quality. We're really known for that, but we're also really known for being around a long time. You know, like I'm one of the old guys in the industry today.
How about that?
Yeah. Who would have thunk? I mean, it's still a weird experience for me, because being a nonconformist and a rebel, you know, which is a part of my character, to be looked at as being a part of the establishment right now, it was a weird experience.
It must be painful.
Well, it's different. I think it's more numbing than painful.
I bet.
But the my biggest concern is that there are a number of people who have gotten into this business and this industry, and they've not been prepared. Technically, they've not gone to brewing school. They have very little experience beyond their own kitchen. They have no commercial experience when it comes to repeatability of results and packaging. They may not be prepared emotionally, or they may not be prepared financially. And these are some critical moments of where, yes, I mean, today, all of us can agree that there's never been more styles of beer out there than ever before in the history of this country. But there's also never been more substandard beer in the shelves and on tap lines than ever before. Mm. And so what I would describe as the amateurism, mm-hmm. that side of this mm-hmm. business, I get concerned of the amateurs eroding not only my profession, but the credibility of the craft segment. Mm-hmm. So people will say, but boy, you know, I'm an entrepreneur and I'm going to go after this. Mm-hmm. It's a profession like anything else. I mean, it wasn't too long ago, a retired attorney who made a bunch of money, and his brother-in-law was a hedge fund broker. They're starting a brewery, and it happens to be that the attorney was a home brewer, a ribbon-winning guy. And when he told me that he was going to be, you know, running the operation, I looked at him one afternoon. I said, well, what would you tell me if I said to you that I was going to rent a storefront out on West 7th Street and practice law without a license? It didn't go over very well. But that's how I see the world, because, it is food manufacturing. It's serious business. You really need to know what you're doing. I know of no other profession that's out there where the customer pays for a business person's learning curve.
Mm.
Ethically, mm-hmm. that kind of hits me a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So I find myself patiently listening to a number of people who are enamored with this industry and really want to be a part of it. And then when they describe their business plan, those are some key things that I look for.
Mm-hmm.
Quality assurance is essential.
Well, I got to tell you, Mark, I've known you for a lot of years. And, you know, you have an extraordinary reputation as a human being and a philanthropist and a welcoming, engaging, larger-than-life personality. And yet I always have found you to be quietly humble, hard to get to know, because I think you are more quiet and reserved about who Mark is. I find you to be a poet of beer. When we want to talk about something that matters, you want to talk about things deeply. And I appreciate that about you. And so I'm interested in knowing a little bit more about Mark the man. When you think about where you are today, what has this community given back to you? Because I see you as, again, I see you as a philanthropist and a servant of the community. If there's an activity, Summit's there supporting it. If there's a bike ride, I see Summit shirts riding down the road. If there's an event that is supporting any priority that I see running through this marketplace, Summit's in the center of it, and that speaks to who you are as an individual. How has that community engagement mattered to you?
Well, I did say a deep value of mine of, first of all, we believe that what we do for a living, we add to the quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
And the enjoyment and experience of life and being with others. There's, you know, just an old expression that beer always tastes best with friends, no matter what it is.
Mm.
So historically, there's this connection between breweries and the community. Usually a brewery would be the first thing that would be established after the church, but not always when a community would start. So I think it's very important to not only have a very, you know, solid business of employing people, but giving back to the community is another way of just improving the quality of life overall. It's something that, you know, personally, yeah, I live in St. Paul. I have a business in St. Paul. I spent 14 years restoring a row house that had been rental property for 70 years that's in St. Paul, and it's kind of a personal historic piece of my lifestyle, I guess. Doing woodwork would keep me sane at nights and weekends. Hmm. And I'd be able to turn that switch off and not think about the business on a continual basis. And a part of it is I'm way too task-oriented for my own good. But being involved in the community is essential. It speaks more than, you know, when I say what we do for a living adds to the quality of life. Well, then we also should mean that and extend ourselves and be active, whether or not it's volunteerism or supporting organizations or even when we had very little money or had no money to offer organizations, we would offer up the house, so to speak. We would open up the brewery and say, you know, we're not interested in selling you beer, but if you want to have this space to, you know, have your own meetings or a gathering, here it is, and then we'll provide some hospitality. It is that simple. Hospitality is essential, I believe, in society. It's anything from being greeted at a restaurant or checking into a hotel or just how you treat your neighbors if they want a cup of coffee. Maybe that's a part of my small-town upbringing and being very acquainted with rural life, of being dependent on neighbors and knowing neighbors. I think those are some of the values that are running through this experience.
Well, you are to be commended. You are such a good neighbor. And I think you personify the how we want to see ourselves as a community, which is that good neighbor. I don't want that to underrepresent how extraordinary is the organization that you've built. Summit has won some amazing awards. And perhaps on the back of that community engagement, people love you. They love your brand. They love the quality of your beer. EPA is my personal favorite, which you know very well. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at a series of awards that Summit has won. And in particular, in 2018, you won a very special award.
Oh, the Leader of the Pack.
Leader of the Pack.
Yeah, which the ceremony was postponed due to a blizzard. So
Imagine that.
So we didn't get together this spring. but we'll get together for that celebration in the fall. But it's I've been very honored in many ways from very different types of organizations over the years. And when the International Wolf Center gave me a shout and let me know that they had selected me, I thought, oh, okay.
Well, and tell us what that honor represents.
Well, essentially... the International Wolf Center recognizes leaders, and it could be business, it can be ethics, it can be science, leaders within the state of Minnesota. So it's a statewide award, and they really focused on me and Summa Brewing Company as not only being that pioneer in this industry, but a consistent leader throughout. And again, I knew with how we've integrated ourselves within the communities.
Well, you are such a humble man. For those of you listening, you'll have to Google it and look it up because there's lots more to that story than our humble guest is sharing with you. And also, 2018 was important because Summit became the best-selling beer in the state.
Yeah, we achieved this notoriety of being the largest brewery in the state.
How about that?
And well... Again, it's something that I never, going back to 1986 when we were preoccupied with survival,
right.
It would not have really registered as even a possibility. When we started up, both Schmidt Brewing Company and Stroh's Brewing was chugging right along and right here in St. Paul, and we were under the shadow of both of those sizable breweries, so it also is a statement of how the industry has really changed. And I believe that small breweries are going to be a part of our social matrix, a part of the brewing industry for many, many decades to come. There's an intense interest in regional manufacturing and regional production of whether or not it's food or beer or clothing or cars. We really need to have a manufacturing backbone as a part of our economy. That's something that I cannot overstate.
Mm. Well, on that note, when you think about this generation is notably defined by the entrepreneurial nature,
mm-hmm.
and now that you're one of the institutions of leadership in the business community, can you give one piece of advice for someone considering starting his or her own business, not necessarily in brewing,
sure,
but
sure.
the beginning of that adventure? Looking back, what is something you would have liked to have been told yourself?
Mm. Well, I mentioned earlier that Jerry Mogul told me right away that luck is a product of hard work.
Mm-hmm.
I've never worked harder in my life, and I thought I had a difficult job before I started this business. So anyone needs to be very prepared to work hard, period.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, it's essential to have a business plan and to really do solid due diligence and research in the industry that you're looking at. It's essential. Most of the failures of people that I've witnessed in this industry and otherwise are those who have not looked into something as simple as regulatory issues, compliance issues, market dynamics, distribution models. All of that needs to be really examined, and a business plan is also just a platform of preparation. It's not possible to anticipate everything. And in fact, when I talk to people about my experience, it's critical to our survival that we don't know what's going to happen. If we knew what the heck was going to happen, we wouldn't take the risk.
Right.
And taking that risk is the inherent part of the experience.
Mm. It's the risk that separates the business owner from the non-business owner. It isn't necessarily that one is... I used to think, like you, that someone who had their own business was somehow smarter than I. And the truth is, he or she might have been braver.
Yeah.
Really.
Risk is a process.
Yeah.
Risk is a process. It never goes away.
I have one final question for you.
Oh.
First of all, delighted that you're here.
Thank you.
And my final question is, did your father finally bless this business venture of yours?
Oh, absolutely he did.
Did he?
Yeah. No, he relished in watching it not only survive, but grow and... my father was able to see the acquisition of the adjacent property and the installation of the can line, the commissioning of the new cellar, which doubled our capacity. So he was able to witness most of the larger projects, so to speak, that happened just in the past handful of years. So, yeah.
You know he was so proud of you.
Yeah, yeah. I never brought him beer back to Wahpeton because I wanted him to go out and support his local liquor store. And then I told him I'd give him an expense allowance.
Very nice. Well, Mark, thank you for taking the time.
Well, thank you.
Couldn't have enjoyed myself more. So this is Bee's Table Talk. Thank you for joining us. And Mark Stutrud, thank you. And get out there and buy a Summit. What's the season's beer?
Well, we just released a new unfiltered aromatic low ABV IPA called Slugfest.
Slugfest.
It's a little bit of a metaphor on what's going on in the marketplace. we also just released a Cabin Crusher for the summer, which is a Kolsch, a German ale, that's been infused with some lime peel and lime puree. The summer ale was just released, so we have a number of new offerings out there, and our newest Czech Pilsner, Dakota Soul, is selling strong. We're getting great response to that, as well as our Bavarian-style Pilsner, our Keller Pils.
Marvelous.
Yes.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Have a great afternoon.
Thank you.